This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On ABC Listen.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Don't worry, are you ready to run?
That is the sound of striking teachers today in Melbourne. A statewide strike for the first time in 13 years. 30,000 public school teachers, principals and education support staff out for 24 hours over pay and conditions. I'm Mary Guerin. This is The Conversation Hour. There's a rally planned in Mildura as well. But the main one is in the CBD of Melbourne. Union says that crowds of teachers are travelling in to add their voices. They've been rallying at Victoria's Trades Hall since 10:30 or so, a half hour ago. They'll march to Parliament House for a second rally. We're going to cross to the scene in this hour and tell you what's happening and also update you on disruptions to traffic and transport in the CBD. But of course, the impact is beyond the CBD. It's to households across the state. More than 1,500 schools stand to be affected. Tell me what you're thinking. It's a packed hour ahead. Have you read about the fuel siphoning incidents in Kyneton? A few people woke there on Saturday morning to find their fuel flaps on their car forced open, their tanks drained. Those are just their cars sitting on the street. Has it happened to you or someone that you know? 1300 222 774. And what can you do to stop it? Police say they're investigating, but how can you actually stop fuel theft from a car sitting on a street? Particularly if you're like me, you don't have off-street parking, it's an older car, it's vulnerable. We'll get some tips this hour. Also, later, we'll be talking about fuel and livestock theft in country areas. Livestock theft is up, but arrests are not keeping up. Has this affected you? 1300 222 774 is the number to call. But also this hour, let's forget the cars. Most of us have, luckily, access to free transport we can use at all hours of the day. Our pairs of pins, our plates of meat, yes, our legs and our feet. We're talking walking. We're talking the walk today. You might remember last week we talked about the new active transport plan in Victoria, aiming to make 25% of all trips active transport by 2030. That means walking and cycling. We talked last week about cycling. Today is about walking. Are you walking more or planning to, nudged by that fuel crisis or for the conversation around the environment, for sustainability, for affordability in general? If you're not planning on walking, what's stopping you? We want to talk about the systemic issues here as well. Also, we are talking, keeping an eye on what's happening with those teacher strikes. Eric, you've called from Ballarat. What do you want to say?
Yeah, well, as a grandparent, it's a pretty amazing place to be in. We've got some young grandchildren both in prep and grade two now, and the fact that their teachers are taking industrial action is not bad news. It's in fact good news, because we've seen a rundown of the state school system over a little while, and for this to happen the first time in 13 years, you've got to be scratching your head and saying there must be a whole lot of built-up frustration and problems within our system. And it clearly comes back to a pretty straightforward decision if you look at the salary comparisons to other states and the conditions comparisons. So as a grandparent, I'm happy to see it happen. I hope it doesn't happen again, and I hope there's a positive resolution.
Indeed. Eric, have you got the grandkids today?
No, the grandkids are a little bit away today, but we've been looking after them off and on. And, you know, they've got great schools. One of the schools they go to is not affected by the stop work, but the teachers there are monumentally concerned, and it's always that a bind between loyalty to the kids and the parents and loyalty to your own profession. And a lot of teachers who aren't taking stop work action, I'm sure, will be watching very, very keenly and saying, you know, it pulls my heart not to take the action. But it sounds like from your reporting there's many, many thousands of teachers who are taking that action, along with the hardworking education support staff and our principals as well.
Indeed, some principals as well. Eric, thank you for calling in. Ron, you've called in as well. What do you think?
Am I on?
Yes, you are on.
Oh, great. Look, I believe the federal and state government spend $20 billion. That's $20 billion. That's almost a third of the money we make from gas exports, I think. I think that they spend $20 billion on private schools, which are in Muslim private schools, and which would tax the Catholic and other churches because they make a fortune. The Catholic Church has got more money than the second largest government expense. They've got more money than the federal and state government.
Ron, interesting point and angle to bring up there. Yes, indeed, this strike is about the public schools, and what that means for the strength and the sustainability of our public schools as well is part of the teachers' remit today in their strike. Thank you, Ron, for calling in. But coming up next, how do you stop someone siphoning fuel from your car?
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
And it's a quarter past 11. Well, you may have seen some reports about multiple incidents of fuel siphoning in Kyneton. Victoria Police are looking into it. They say there's no notable trends of escalating petrol theft following recent price increases. So, how do you even think about protecting your car and the fuel from your car? Joining us now is James Williams, Head of Policy from RACV. Thanks for joining us, James.
Oh, good morning, Mary.
What did you think when you saw these reports?
Well, RACV certainly appreciated that fuel is becoming a significant issue. It's front of mind for many motorists at the moment. And clearly, people are very concerned. When it comes to siphoning fuel, there are certainly some things that we can do to certainly be overlooked. Or to diminish the risk of having your fuel stolen.
Before we get into tips, which I really want to hear let's get back to getting this into context. Is this something that has happened generally that you hear of outside of times of, you know, global fuel crises?
No, but I don't know if you recall, if you're old enough, Mary, to remember back in the 80s, we used to have fuel flats with little locks on them.
Mm-hmm.
And that was certainly a direct response to the fuel crisis of the 1970s. And you can see where we're potentially going down that path again, but certainly at this point in time, we're not there yet.
So there were those fuel caps, and I do remember being in a family car with that. Why did they disappear?
Well, it became less of an issue. And we see that this is a direct response to what's happening in the marketplace. Clearly, fuel is becoming more expensive. We're seeing fuel at $2.240 at the moment, up to almost $2.50 around the state, although there is some variance there. So clearly, it's a knee-jerk reaction to fuel prices.
You're listening to James Williams. He is Head of Policy at RACV. So tell us, what can we do? Does the ultimate answer lie in getting those fuel caps with locks back in the system?
Well, Mary, there's a number of things that you can do, and RACV certainly appreciates that fuel flaps that you have on your car are very easy to unlock with a screwdriver. So if a thief is serious about siphoning your fuel, they can get into your tank at the moment. And there's a few things you can do to reduce that risk, and certainly the best thing you can do is buy an aftermarket lockable fuel cap. And that's something that many retailers have available. They're harder to break than plastic, so they're made of steel, and they're a handy deterrent for the opportunistic thief. And that has a lock. So you open the flap, and then there's a key and you can open it. So it's like a lock inside the flap.
Are these available for all models of car of all ages?
It's an aftermarket device. Certainly, we've been able, from what we can see, we haven't heard or experienced any fuel caps, lockable fuel caps, that haven't fitted. But we'll monitor that because that's certainly an issue. And, of course, they might not always necessarily be available as the issue accelerates. And the other thing is, Mary, you mentioned this before, it's not everyone can park in a locked garage, but mm-hmm. if you can, that's very important to do that. And the other thing to consider is that if you do have to park outside, choose a well-lit area where your car is visible to passers-by. And the other tip, which I actually really love, and it's very simple and very obvious, but consider parking your car where your fuel cap is close to a wall, a fence or a tree, so that it's difficult for the thief to actually navigate his or her way into that space to collect the fuel.
That is creative. I can imagine now people going very creatively up onto sidewalks or something there. Is that
As long as it's legally parked.
As long as it's legally parked.
And safe.
Absolutely. Yes, the head of policy, the RACV, has to say that. Because essentially these thieves only really need a tube to get into the tank and using suction. But you're saying if they don't have enough space, they can't do it.
That's right. Just make it harder for them. And the trick is it's a little bit like OBD ports to access your vehicle's CAN bus, or even indeed a steering wheel lock to prevent car theft, or anti-theft screws on your number plates. It's about the thief looking at that and going, oh no, that's too hard, I'll move on to the next one.
Mm.
So the harder that you can make it for the thief, the better you are, and the less likely you are that your fuel will be stolen.
Yes, a good general tip about household safety in all respects. It's 20 minutes past 11. I'm talking with James Williams, head of policy at the RACV, about fuel siphoning. And I guess just finally, James, what would you have to say in general about fuel saving tips? I mean, in conjunction with this issue of siphoning, is someone like me has no off-street parking, and combine that with prices, do I need to, for instance, fill up with less amount of fuel more often? Is that potentially part of the answer?
There's a number of things you can do to reduce your fuel and to be more efficient with your fuel, Mary. And certainly it's how you drive, and that's a very simple change. So smooth driving, maintaining steady speeds, and avoiding rapid acceleration or harsh braking can certainly reduce your fuel use, as well as simple things like maintaining tyre pressure and wheel alignment. So if you have your tyre pressure at the right level, that will reduce your fuel, as well as the weight of your car. So if you can remove excess weight, a lot of people keep things on roof racks or in the boot of your car. If you can remove those, it all helps to reduce your fuel use. And also consider, is it necessary that I drive? I mean, certainly you look at today, Mary, with everything going on in the city, you'd say, well, is there an alternative to taking the car today to get in? Is public transport an option? And is walking an option? And you mentioned earlier the active transport plan. And walking, it's a really good option if you can do it.
James Williams, you've given me the ultimate segue into our next conversation. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Pleasure, Mary. Thank you.
That's James Williams from RACV, Head of Policy. Yes, we are talking about how we can all use less fuel by walking. That is our next conversation. Indeed. Eric in Warrigal says, though no one siphons fuel from an EV. Very good point, Eric. We've been talking about that as well. Wendy from Emerald says, my car's fuel tank flap is locked when the car is locked. No prob. And Joe says, back to the 70s and 80s, lots of siphoning then. This is in response to some reports from social media talking about siphoning happening. Victoria Police appear to confirm that they do believe that unknown offenders have tampered with fuel cap covers. So we'll continue on with that. Keep in touch with the police to see if that issue is a genuine one, is taking off around the state as well. It is 23 minutes past 11. Are you walking more or planning to? And if not, what's stopping you?
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
It's 23 minutes past 11. Yes, last week we talked about the active transport plan for Victoria, where 25% of all trips by 2030 should be active, that is, cycling or walking. And at the time, we received a text saying, please don't forget to talk about walking in this discussion when we've been talking about bikes. We thought we'd pick that up today. Joining me now is Cathy Lazanis, who is the director of Victoria Walks. Thanks for joining us, Cathy.
Thanks, Mary. Great to be here.
What would you have to say about how common it is at the moment to have active transport walking as transport trips in Victoria?
Yeah, it's a great question, Mary. So currently we're sitting at around 17% of all active transport trips are by walking. And when we talk about, you know, what does that mean, it's, you know, it's walking trips, whether it's work-related, education, recreation, personal, or even for shopping.
And they are mostly short trips, is that right?
That's right. So, you know, the thing with walking is that it's we all do it. We don't really even think about it, some of us, but we do know that there's about 1 million trips that are under 1 kilometre every week that are currently driven. And what we'd love to do is shift that to walking, because that's where we can have a huge amount of impact to try and achieve that target that you talked about, that the government has laid out in its current active transport plan of trying to get all trips of, you know, by 25% by 2030 to be by active transport.
We're asking you this morning, are you walking more or planning to? And if not, what is actually stopping you? 1300 222 774 is the number to call, or 0437 774 774. Text me with what could be stopping you from doing that. Because Kathy, you're talking about a lack of investment. There are structural issues in many people's experience in terms of their willingness or ability to walk.
Yeah, I think that's right. And, you know, we've seen that over the years. And you know, if we sort of look back at COVID, our walking numbers were about 23% back then. And as I said, now we're sitting at about 17%, which is just where we were pre-COVID. So it's not like we've gone drastically backwards, but we have from COVID. And not that any of us want to return to those times. I, you know, hasten to add that very quickly.
Yes, but, my eyes twitching.
Yes, but you know, from a walking point of view, we really need to tap into what was different then and to where we are now, because, you know, it's too easy that our habits have gone back to where we were. Whereas, you know, we had some great community interventions, we had pop-up parks, we had the ability for people to walk around their local communities, and, you know, things like you know, short trips, whether it's a school run or whatever it might be, those under 1 kilometre trips are really the ones that we should be focusing on if we're trying to achieve our target.
Kathy, you mentioned that as a side note, but if we can just go down this avenue for a second, do you think, indeed you are correct, that my memories of all of the walking trips, you know, along my local creek and, you know, parkways and so forth is very heavily associated with lockdown days. Do you believe that there's anything in that, that there's a little bit of knee-jerk reaction? I don't mean to say PTSD in a flippant way, but there is some sort of bad association with that in Melbourne in particular?
Oh, look, I think it's more the fact that we're creatures of habit. And, you know, unless we change our habits, we just sort of revert to form. And I think that's really what's happened post-COVID. And, you know, one of the things that we like to look at is school trips. Like, you know, if we go back to the 70s, 1 in 2 kids were walking to school. It was a bit of a, you know, a bit of a no-brainer, really. Whereas now it's about 1 in 5. So about 20% of kids are walking to school. And what we know is that it's actually, it's a decline in environment and and behaviour. It's not just the distance, because the distance to school and walking to school, particularly in our sort of more urban areas, really hasn't changed that much, but it's actually the way we behave and the environment that's actually changed and shaped those behaviours. So it's really trying to unpack some of those barriers to walking, and you know, I think the plan does try to do that, as it divides the walking into 5 different pillars and helps us sort of unpack the layers that makes up walking.
We will get to those pillars in a minute, but let me know what is the barrier to you walking more. 1300 222 774 is the number to call. What would you like to see? Kathy Lozanis, what are those 5 pillars in the plan, and can you bring it back to, I guess, people's lived experience?
Sure. So the pillars are accessibility and inclusion, places and neighbourhoods, integrated transport and safe streets, health and wellbeing, and climate response. And I think, you know, what we love about these pillars is that the government's taking an approach which is that walking is made up of lots of different areas, and it's its biggest challenge, but it's also its biggest opportunity, because the idea is that if we can actually focus on walking as an activity of accessibility and inclusion and about health and well-being and also response to climate and transport, it means that we're actually being able to focus on really highlighting how people can walk and the power and the impact that walking can have.
Is it also a matter of an urban regional divide? I'm seeing on text people saying that, yep, they walk to the shops, but of course that's much more possible for some than others.
Sure, definitely. We definitely know that the numbers in our regional communities are much lower, and that one is around distance. You know, that's that real difference of it's not 1 million trips under 1 kilometre. It's much the numbers are vaster. But even in those contexts, it is about having a setting whereby people can actually connect and stay and walk in the community, or, you know, whether it's down to the local shops and go to the cafes once they get there. I think the other part is the huge opportunity that we have, particularly when we think about how Melbourne's growing. Our greenfield developments are really, really important, and the plan does talk to this, and I think it's really critical, because where we have, you know, new housing developments and estates, often what we've seen in the past is that these get developed, the houses come in, the driveway gets delivered along with a double garage, but then we don't have that connection to the local shopping centre or even to the local primary school with a footpath. And, you know, the plan talks about this as thoughtful development sequencing, and I think that's just a really fancy way of saying we just need to plan a little bit better.
Yep. We are talking about walking, active transport for all sorts of reasons, maybe fuel, maybe environment, maybe fitness. Doris has texted saying that she is 56, working in a cafe 1 kilometre from my home. Big hill between me and work, easy to walk to work, not so easy on the return trip after a long shift on old feet. Just want to let you know that later in this hour we are going to be talking to a podiatrist to talk about feet and walking, because for so many people, of course, you know, there are a lot of people who don't have the physical capability of doing that. Cathy Lozanis, I'm sure you would be saying that some of the infrastructure you're talking about is for people who also have accessibility and mobility issues as well.
Absolutely. So the way that we consider walking, it's everybody who we actually think of it as being the most inclusive form of transport, because regardless if you're on two legs or you're on a mobility scooter or walking aids, wheelchairs or prams, they're all using the same pieces of infrastructure, which is footpaths. And, you know, there's this great school of thought, Mary, that talks about if we design our towns, cities and communities for an 8-year-old and an 80-year-old, we're actually designing for everybody. So, you know, it's the 8-year-old child who can walk to school, and it's the 80-year-old who can go for a walk and go down to the local shops and, you know, make sure they've got things like a flat footpath that's unbroken and, you know, some good shading from trees and maybe even occasional bench where they can pause as well. All those little incremental pieces make up the fabric of walking.
And make up the culture around it. You're listening to Cathy Lozanis, who is Director of Victoria Walks. This on text as well, safety. Women won't walk if they don't think it's safe. That's from Nicole. What would you have to say about that, Cathy?
Yeah, it's huge, and safety is a really important one, because it's physical, but it's also the perception of safety as well. So we know that women, particularly in Victoria, only 54% feel safe walking at night, and that's not great numbers. You know, we want everyone to be able to feel safe walking at night, and so that comes down to things like lighting and having passive surveillance. And one of the things that we know is that once people see more people like themselves walking, they'll also walk. So it's almost like this self-fulfilling piece, but we need to get people to feel comfortable, and that actually comes with having really good infrastructure. And like I said, things like lighting, or, you know, shops that are open a little bit later, and, you know, we're really well-designed communities, so we don't have those areas where people feel unsafe.
1300 222 774 is the number to call if you want to tell us if you're walking more, if you're planning to, if not, what's stopping you. We also will talk about feet, how to take care of our feet to find the right shoes. We'll be joined by a podiatrist a little later as well. Jim in Carlton has this creative solution potentially, Cathy. More walking equals healthier people equals lower health costs. Solution: make KPIs or bonuses of senior transport bureaucrats tied to an improved health outcome of the population. What do you think?
I think that's ingenious.
Good on you, Jim.
Look, I think that, you know, for the longest time, we know that we acknowledge and we know the benefits, the health benefits of walking. And I think that that's that's very much ingrained in our culture. You know, we often think about, you know, taking the dog for a walk, or, you know, whether it's trying to get your 10,000 steps in. So we definitely have a really strong link between the health benefits and walking. What I think we probably need to see is to really try and achieve this target is it's more about those incidental walking activities. So one of the things that I love to talk about is, you know, how people get to school or education or work is, you know, the moment you start that trip in a car, you're going to end it in a car. Whereas if you're going to choose to use public transport, that journey starts with a walk. It either starts with a short walk to a bus stop or a longer walk to a train station or a tram stop, for example. But it means you're actually walking, and it's all those incidental pieces of walking that actually can really change how our communities work.
Mm. So Jim, who came up with that ingenious solution, is on the line now. Hi, Jim.
Hello.
Hello, Jim.
Yeah, I live fairly central in the city, so yeah, I do a lot of walking.
Yeah, and you believe that the bureaucrats should be the ones getting behind it?
I think people got to realise one part of it, it's an engineering, a road and traffic engineering issue. People have to be able to walk around, they have to be able to not be encumbered by being the last people considered at the traffic lights, so that they're waiting a long time to cross roads or intersections. Yeah, and the only way around it is to make sure that the senior bureaucrats in those areas, that their key performance indicators include at the very top improvements in health and population.
Mm. Jim, thank you. Thanks. And you, so many suggestions here coming through on texts, really emphasising what you've talked about, Kathy. Lack of footpaths is an issue in some areas, says this one. Poorly designed suburbs which have been developed and councils that have approved them. This, live in an old part of Geelong, no footpaths, so have to walk on the road. Don't feel safe to walk locally, especially with a young child. And this, in some areas, joggers are running in bike lanes on the roads because they're so entitled. They expect the whole walking path to themselves. So if someone doesn't move in time, they don't want to run a few steps on the grass. So that goes to, I guess, a matter of crowding and so forth. Kathy Lozanas, we've talked about this active transport plan. Strategies and plans sometimes leave me a little bit cold. How confident are you that these deeper structural issues are going to be attacked because of this plan?
I think that's a great question, Mary. And I think, you know, we now have a home for walking, and I think that's the first step that we really need to acknowledge and commend the government for, because I think it's too easy to say everyone should walk more or we should make walking easier, and that doesn't happen if we don't break that down and we don't also acknowledge some of the barriers that are in the way from stopping those things from changing. And I think the plan does do that. It also calls out the fact that really councils are the custodians of walking in many ways, and you know, they have to do a lot of the heavy lifting, because it's council's remit to look after the footpaths, not only to often install them, but then also to maintain them when they break or when tree roots come through. Mm-hmm. But then also putting in new infrastructure, like where it's wombat crossings or safer pedestrian crossings, that's really important as well. And I think enabling councils to have that conversation with state government, and really a lot of this will come ultimately down to funding, and that's one thing that we'd love to see. And it'd be remiss of me not to call that out in an election year, I think. You know, we do see our other counterparts in other states and territories that really do back walking, and they provide real funding for that. And I think that that's probably just the missing piece of the puzzle, but really happy to see that we do have a home for walking now.
Kathy Lozanas, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Mary.
Kathy Lozanas is the director of Victoria Walks. Kevin, you've called from Geelong. There was a text about that before. What do you think?
My observation is that Geelong is a very, very car-centric city, and that the council do absolutely nothing to ameliorate the worst effects of that. The single-occupant cars that are tootling around the streets, just extraordinary. And there's so many things that they could be doing in a more an imaginative kind of way to encourage more walking and more pedestrians, and yet it just doesn't happen.
What would you like to see?
Well, more walking paths for one thing. A greater emphasis on public transport, like you mentioned before, because the public transport around here is, and I live in the city, let me tell you, I live in the city, and it's atrocious. Like, it finishes, you know, at 6 p.m. in the evening, and it doesn't start until 7 o'clock in the morning. So there's not even that tiny opportunity to walk to the bus stop.
Kevin, that's really interesting. Thank you for your call. So many interesting calls and texts on this. We should, I think, continue to look into this. Jane says, as a serial walker, many drivers no longer seem to register the existence of walkers, probably not intentional. And Jane always wears brightly coloured flowing scarves to increase my visibility. Good on you, Jane. Probably look really good as well. Thank you for all of the texts and calls. And I will get back to more of them as the conversation goes on. We will get to the podiatrist who might have be able to answer your questions on how to take care of your feet when you're getting more into walking. But coming up next, livestock theft is up in Victoria, but the arrests aren't keeping up. And so along with fuel thefts, there's that emerging as an issue in the regions.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
It's 20 minutes to 12. We will be joined by Dr. Helen Banwell, who will guide you through all your questions about how to keep your feet healthy. But first, the reports of livestock theft from Victorian farms are up. They've increased by almost 15% in the past year, but only one arrest made in that time. What is happening when it comes to rural crime? Joining me now is Kyle J.D. Mulrooney, the Senior Lecturer in Criminology and Co-Director of the Centre for Rural Criminology. Hard to say, but very pleasant to have you here, Kyle. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
I want to talk about fuel in a moment, but let's talk about that livestock theft last year. What did you find?
So we've done a national survey, so covering all of Australia, and we're looking at about 40% of farmers have reported they've experienced livestock theft. Now, you've got to sort of interpret this because not every farmer who answers our survey farms livestock. So it's quite a significant number that are experiencing livestock theft across Australia.
Is there any reason behind it that you can tell?
Well, it's a mix of the environment as well as police capacity. So the rural environment's not very apt for crime prevention. It's not a busy city street. You don't have formal guardians like the police. You really don't have informal guardians like people around. You don't have the technology usually like CCTV and things like that. So it's quite an opportunistic space for thieves. Like, you can think of cattle a couple thousand dollars walking around on four legs and really no eyes or ears in paddocks to see people commit these offenses. So it's quite an easy offense to commit. It's quite a lucrative offense to commit. On the other end, when it comes to actually investigation and policing, it's quite challenging. Oftentimes, the offenses won't be reported immediately. Farmers might not count their stock as regularly. So it can go days, weeks, even months. And by the time the police find out about it, you know, there's absolutely little to no evidence to go off of, if there was any to begin with. So it's a really, really challenging crime to actually prevent, but also respond to and solve.
So, Kyle, what you're saying there is it's a mixture of the lack of reporting that doesn't help police. Do you believe, though, that the police response is that they're trying to get across it?
Yeah, it varies quite considerably across Australia. So I know that Victoria has farm crime liaison officers who part of their responsibility is farm crime. New South Wales has a dedicated rural crime prevention team, and they've seen some significant success as it pertains to farm crime, and especially as it pertains to community relationships by going that route. But you're absolutely right. There is an absolute dark figure when it comes to rural crime, especially when you're looking at police reported statistics. So, for instance, even with stock theft, we said that 40% had experienced it, and in and around 30% of that 40 actually reported it. And then when we asked them whether they've reported it ever or have they reported it the last time it happened, you see another significant drop off, meaning that people have reported in the past, and then they don't continue to report it, likely because they haven't had a very positive outcome. But the aggregate effect is extremely low reporting. And this is true across all offence types, not just livestock theft.
You're listening to Kyle J.D. Mulrooney, who's from the University of New England. And we're talking about livestock theft that you've been looking at there. You looked at that over a certain period that did not include I guess, what we're seeing with the war in the Middle East. And, of course, this relates to Victorian farmers being warned to lock gates and guard against fuel theft as well. Do you believe that rural crime may be increasing at the moment?
Yeah, I'm sure when it comes to fuel theft, again, we haven't captured that number because of how recent everything's been. I'm sure the police reported statistics, which, again, there's a big gap in fuel theft, would still speak to that rise currently. We saw it at the beginning of the Ukraine-Russia conflict when prices rose there as well. We did see a significant increase. It is one of the top offenses experienced by farmers in our national survey. So about 35% have experienced it in their lifetime. So it's quite significant for farmers, and less than 30% actually report it. So actually what is getting to the police is much, much less, again, similar to livestock, than what is actually happening and what farmers are telling us is actually happening.
Have you found what is proving most effective in terms of guarding against this crime?
Yeah, again, it is such a challenging space for crime prevention. There are a lot of interesting agricultural technologies primarily used for farming improvement that can help. For instance, smart ear tags in cattle that allow a quite high level of traceability with GPS. CCTVs and internet connectivity has come a very long way. And so you're increasingly seeing farms set up through companies like Landwatch and others that actually develop dedicated agricultural capturing video, number plate recognition, these types of things. So as technology does improve, as connectivity improves, I think that that environment is becoming more difficult for the offender, and hopefully that will lead to a longer term reduction. But again, you're just dealing with such a highly criminogenic environment, really. It's very difficult, just the sheer size of Australian farms, and trying to have, you know, police, let alone just people aware of the offences that are occurring and trying to report them in a timely manner. And then again, you've got that gap. Even when the farmer is aware, that information isn't always flowing up the chain to the police. And then even worse and further than that, to policymakers and the people that can actually dedicate resources and attention to these issues.
Mm. And just finally, Kyle, Rob from Moorabark says, why not put e-tags on cattle so they can track them if stolen? I think in passing, you say that is part of the raft of measures that people are using?
Yeah, so we tested at the Centre for Rural Criminology a tag out of Queensland called Fairies Tag. And it was really, really fascinating. We've got a research paper published open access on that if anyone can look it up. But basically, it allowed us to track GPS movement. So it would alert us if the stock was taken from the geofence that we're able to build. But also on top of that, it has an accelerometer. And basically what that means is it can tell us a lot about the cattle's movement or the stock's movement. And so if they're being mustered, you're getting an alert right away, you know, so that time window that we talked about in terms of actually knowing when this offense is occurring and reporting it was closed dramatically, because the farmer can see pretty much immediately that something is going on with the sheep or the steers, and they should go check it out. And so it was quite promising in that regard.
Maybe technology can work for us. Kyle, thank you so much for your time today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. You take care.
You too. Kyle J.D. Mulrooney, who is co-director of the Centre for Rural Criminology at the University of England. We are talking about walking as well today. And joining me now is Dr. Helen Banwell, who is Program Director of Podiatry at the University of South Australia. Thanks for joining us, Helen.
Oh, good morning. How are you all?
Very well, thank you. We've been talking about the new Victorian goals of getting 25% of our transport trips by 2030 to be active, that is cycling or walking. We've been talking about the structural issues potentially that stop us from walking. But of course, there's the structure of our feet we need to think about. There are so many questions coming in on text, and I will get to them. And please do text 0437 774 774 or call 1300 222 774. But Helen, how do people need to prepare their feet, as it were, for walking?
For walking. Well, let's be really honest. Our feet are very bony. So there's a quarter of the body's bones are in the feet. So there's lots of joints there. So there is lots of things that can go wrong with those joints. And, you know, foot pain's very, very common. So it is important to have a really good look at how you're going to approach these things. And, you know, I've been in practice long enough that I, and I'm guilty of it myself, of being the weekend warrior, you know, doing absolutely no prep during the week and then getting up on a Sunday morning and going, oh, look, 2 hour walk, that'll be fine.
But you should know better.
Exactly. But the reality is that, you know, it can take a little bit of time for your feet to get there. And more importantly, you really do need to think about what you're going to house those feet in when you're walking. Because one, you want to protect from the environment. If you're outside, you don't want to be stepping on glass or anything like that. But two, you need to think about what your feet need. Because some of us have got very, very stable feet, very rigid feet, in fact, and we probably need a bit of cushioning, whereas others of us have probably got quite wobbly feet and they may need a bit of stability. So going to speak to somebody about the type of shoe that fits your foot, you know, a function, is probably one of the best places that you'll start. And then slowly wear that shoe in. But blisters and calluses are the most common outcomes when we start heading off on a new exercise regime. And my two really quick tips before we speak to anybody is, if you know that you are prone to blisters, then there are some things that you can do, such as putting non-elasticated sports tape over the areas that blister, or a clear candle wax around the shoe, and that acts as a lubricant. Very easy. I do it with all the kids' shoes. You know, when you buy kids' shoes and they don't complain as quickly as adults, so by the time they actually tell you they're blistered, they're really big blisters. But a nice bit of soft candle wax around the shoe tends to starve that off.
So within the lining of the shoe?
Yeah, so, you know, then shoes normally rub us in certain spots. It's either around the back of the heel or over the top of the big toe or under the ball of the foot around the big toe. So if you know you're prone to getting blisters there, if you just rub that area in the shoe with some soft candle wax, it can't be the candles you've got in the cupboard and you've had them there for 15 years waiting for the power cut because they're too hard. They won't give off. It's got to be a nice fresh, you know, even a wax melt is perfect. And take it from me, don't use a coloured one because you'll live to regret that.
We're learning from all of Helen's mistakes here. It's terrific. Well, Helen is with us for a few minutes, so do text in 0437 774 774, or call if you have any questions about your feet. This on text, I am a walker but plantar fasciitis has now stopped that. Can I medicate then walk, or am I doing damage, please?
Well, the plantar fasciitis is a tension problem. So the plantar fascia that's attached to the heel bone underneath your foot is being pulled and it's actually starting to separate. So what I always say to people is, please have it taped up so that you're giving it lots of support, and then have somebody tell you why it's pulling. It's often that your calves are too tight. So, as it, you know, and it won't do you any harm to stretch your calves as long as you're gentle about it regardless. So try that first, but also use some tape, and then be really mindful that if you are going to medicate, you're not going to feel the damage until it's too late. So the best course of action is go and see somebody about it and get it fixed.
Indeed, that is very good advice. And do you find that people are returning to walking, and what have you seen in your, from what you've been talking to other professionals about what they're seeing in their practice?
So, you know, I love the Victorian Initiative, by the way, but, you know, we have quite a strong walking culture here in Adelaide. And what I find is, as people get older, it becomes more of a problem. And of course, as we get older, it's also one of the best exercises for us. So it's really important that people, when they do start to walk, go and get some help at the first sign of niggles, because otherwise you're going to get injured and then you're not going to walk as much. And we know it's so good for your health. But also to expect that there probably is going to be some consequences for your feet, because one in four adults do have foot pain.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, and so it's a really common problem, but most of it can be addressed. So don't get put off by the fact that there's likely to be some consequences, but just seek people that can help you and seek really good shoes. And that's half your battle won.
We've got so many texts coming in that I know that we need to pick this up on another day. But just really, really quickly, can you help Gab from Mentone, who's talking about bursitis in her left foot? It won't resolve. Ooh. She's got wide shoes, orthotics, ultrasound and cortisone injections.
Oh, it does depend a bit where she's got the bursitis. arthritis, so I'm assuming it's either around the toes or around the heel. The quarter zone is generally the gold standard sort of end point that we go to, but bursas, and like callus, only form where there is pressure or friction. So it really is getting to the heart of whatever is putting pressure or friction over that, over the area that's impacted.
Very good advice.
On the radio.
Gab, I hope that's helping. And don't worry, I've seen those other texts. I'm going to be saying we should do a whole segment on this very soon. Dr. Helen Banwell, thank you.
You are welcome. Thanks for having me.
Dr. Helen Banwell from the University of South Australia. And as always, there's a disclaimer. Please see your doctor for personalised advice. Let's cross to see what's happening around that teachers' rally. Sasha Payne is on standby for us at ABC. She's the ABC News reporter. You know her. She's at the State Library. Hi, Sasha. What is happening?
Good morning, Mary. Well, yes, I'm just watching the enormous crowd walk past the State Library. They started up at Trades Hall, and there was speeches for a good hour or so up there. Justin Mullally from the union, and many teachers and union leaders talking about their experiences. And now they've started the march down La Trobe Street. They're just turning around into Swanston, and they'll be heading up to State Parliament, where the rally will finish, and there'll be more speeches up there.
I'm not expecting you to have done a head count, Sasha, but how would you talk about the size of the crowd?
Well, I overheard one person saying this, that there's members of other unions here as well, and I overheard someone from the Health Workers Union saying, geez, it's about the best crowd you could possibly expect for a union, union rally. It is absolutely enormous. I've been sitting on this corner for about 5 minutes, and there is still absolutely no sign of this crowd tapering out. It is a very dense crowd. There are definitely tens of thousands of people here. I just can't see the end of the rally at this point.
As we heard earlier in the hour, lots of disruption there for some time. Sasha, thank you for reporting from the scene.
Pleasure, Mary.
That's Sasha Payne, ABC Melbourne reporter. Kevin Butler has called in from Blaze Aid. Hi, Kevin. You wanted to talk about the livestock theft issue we talked about earlier?
Yeah, Mary. I had 381 stolen a few years ago, so I've got a vested interest in this. But currently there's sheep being stolen in the Golden Triangle. That's that, sort of that Wedderburn, Bendigo, Inglewood area. So four reports came in yesterday. Wedderburn, Mysia, and Corong Vale and Curting. And we're asking farmers to check their numbers. But everyone who's reporting in is claiming there's lots of 20 that are being stolen. So they're being, they're merino ewes. They're generally for mutton. They go to a certain trade, and it's been going on for a couple of years. So when we're asking farmers and people, it's rife. It's a highly organised crime, I'm afraid, Mary. Yeah.
Kevin, thank you for telling us. We'll follow up on that, and you'll hear all of the coverage around the rally as well in the city this afternoon. And thank you so much for joining me today. You can catch this again on the ABC Listen app or email me, conversationhour@abc.net.au, about anything you'd like to say about anything we've covered today as well.